Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mehler here. Great to have you along today as we talk about attracting pollinators through the use of small pocket prairie gardens. It's part of a great program going on in Dubuque County, Iowa. And you know what? There's no reason why we couldn't do it right here in good old Wisconsin, I think, even in one of your parks or maybe in your backyard even or your front yard. Three guests involved with the program are with us. One, Dubuque County Master Gardener Coordinator, Ray Cruzy. Ray, welcome to the show.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me today.
Well, it's great to have you with us. Another guest, volunteer coach, Erica Haugen. Erica, welcome.
Thanks, Larry. Glad to be here.
And, well, great to have you here. And finally, a participant mentor. That's Doug's title, Doug Cheever. Doug, thank you for joining in.
And thanks again for having us.
As we talk with our three guests, I hope you'll join in. Maybe you have a kind of a pocket park in your community, or maybe you have some questions about creating one, or maybe some native plant questions. I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Ray, let's start with you. Thanks again, by the way, for reaching out to us about the Mowing for Monarchs program. How did this program get started?
Yeah, well, it didn't really actually start with me. It started with our County Board of Supervisors and our County Conservation Board working together, and they're like, hey, there is this program in Minnesota called Lawns to Legumes, and they're like, could we do something like that here in Dubuque County? And so they were talking with one of our educators here at the Conservation Board, and she's like, yeah, this would be great, but I just don't have the volunteer or, you know, power or the knowledge to do this. So she reached out to me and is like, hey, would the Master Gardeners, you know, would this qualify as a Master Gardener project, and could we move forward with some of the resources you may have? And so this was really, you know, a partnership between our two organizations here in our county, and it's been very successful.
Yeah, I looked at the map of the number of gardens that have been started. It's amazing. What kind of help do you provide?
Yeah, so our Master Gardener, I'm just going to start off from the top. I can't take any credit for what they do. But what they've done is, and Doug is on the call here, is they've really provided a lot of that research behind the selection of the pocket prairie. So each person that signs up to receive a pocket prairie, there's a whole process in applying and things like that. But once they qualify to get that pocket prairie kit, our Master Gardeners have done a ton of research to try and create something that would go in the most yards. So as we know, like, landscapes are diverse and things like that. We've really worked hard to create something that would go in the most yards, and it's kind of like a plug-and-play system, if you want to say.
Yeah. Erica, let me turn to you. If people are maybe wondering, what the heck's a pocket park? And you also have pocket prairies. Let's talk about both. What's a pocket park?
Well, you know, I would say like a pocket park would be more of like a public space, right, where people can come and see these, I guess, native prairie plants or native plants close to the area and interact with them. And it creates ways to connect habitats for pollinators and wildlife across the county.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I imagine a pocket park is different from a pocket prairie would be a different kind of system. What's the pocket prairie like?
Right. And so when we started with Mowing to Monarchs, we started with, we wanted to have this a manageable and attainable way to add native plants to people's yards, essentially. So we started with a plot that was about 100 square feet, and now I think most of our plantings are about 150 square feet. And so it is literally just like the small garden that you could put like you said, in your front yard, and we have different heights of plants that can go into them depending on what your needs are for sun or for shade or if it's going to be close to the street or a sidewalk. And it just creates, if we get enough of them throughout the county, we're seeing that we're creating habitat that endangered insects are using, the butterflies are using, and birds are using.
Yeah, and so 150 square feet, that, you know, like 10 by 15, so that's not a that's not a huge area. And I saw one photo, and I thought to myself, I didn't realize it, but I have my own pocket park because I set up between the sidewalk and the street in front of my house. I have prairie plants, and so here I created my own pocket park, and I didn't even know I was doing it.
Yeah, those street side plantings have become really popular, and I think they're gorgeous, and it's a great way to help more people learn about native plant selection in their area.
Well, you know, that's one spot, but talk about how other spots are maybe located, Erica, so far.
Right. So we have grown the program and expanded the plant selection, and Doug can talk more about this because he's the expert, but we have folks who maybe they don't have full sun, and our initial plants were set up for full sun, as a lot of prairie plants do, but we can grow native plants in lots of different circumstances. And so we have a garden that does well in part sun. And what we look for in site selection with this particular program is we want to take traditional turf grass and lawn and convert that into these native plantings. So that is our main focus, is taking up less of that green space we have with turf and then creating these more livable habitats. So we can do shade, sun, and then we're working on some test plots for this year that will be for under some of our keystone trees.
Very, very cool. And you're a volunteer coach. What does that mean?
Great. So what that essentially means, I applied for the program in its first year, and Doug was my coach, and I had never planted a native plant at all before that. And so I had very little experience working with these, but I had some general experience gardening. And I just fell in love with it. And for me, it was, I wanted to show people how they could create these little spaces in their yard. And it was for showing my neighbors and showing my friends and showing my family. And so people were coming on board and asking me questions. And then I became so familiar with the plants that we were using and how to prepare the sites for them that it was a natural fit to just help other people new to the program who maybe haven't gardened at all, just to give them the confidence that, yes, you can do this and we will show you how. Mm-hmm. And so technically all I really do is I'm like a cheerleader on the sidelines, helping to take the expertise that the master gardeners give us into application.
Oh, man. And Doug, you're a participant mentor and a smart guy, I guess, when it comes to plants.
Let's say I do a lot of, it's called research for a reason. usually I have to go back at it again.
Okay. So what,
we're ahead. We're trying to see what works, because when we started out, we've been doing this now for four growing seasons, and we've had about 400 participants. The biggest issue we had really was we wanted something that was attractive not only to pollinators, but it was also attractive to our neighbors. And this is, you know, in town, you know, we're not developing meadows, as you've learned. They're small areas. The finding a model to go from was, I know of more prairie plantings that have failed in 5 years than have succeeded. So what we have done then is we offer the same package to everyone. We offer enough help that over half of our participants are new gardeners. and we do survey them, and we get comments like, hey, I'm amazed with the results that every single plant thrived, it bloomed, it looked fabulous in the first years. And those immediate results really helped shape positive reactions from my neighbors. And then go on to say, hey, my neighbors and I are counting bees weekly. I'm sharing what I learned with family and friends. I'm teaching neighbor kids about pollinators. You know, and just getting the educational literature was really important for newbies like me.
Wow.
So it's really, we're not recreating the tall grass prairie. That would be too tall and floppy. And frankly, that's not what's going to work in most yards. One of our more successful planting areas has been along the curve. That's high visibility, and for most homeowners, it's a headache. And so we're trying to find, you know, how to share the importance of pollinator habitat with a wider audience. And it's really built a base of 400 people who are still enthusiastic and wanting to do more.
Yeah, I put that space in between the sidewalk and the street. I put that in probably 12 years ago now when we moved into that house. And we thought, for one thing, it was a pain in the butt to mow, to be honest. And I thought, well, why don't we put some prairie plants in there? And my wife at the time said, maybe it was her idea. Let's give her the credit. Doesn't matter, but we put them in and have, you know, it takes a little getting used to getting them set up at a year or two. But once it's going, there's not a whole lot of effort and work involved, Doug.
Yes, other than spraying. We have a lot of trees, and so that means a lot of leaves that got dug out recently. And there's always the question about how much of that do you leave, as Neil DeBolle was covering with you.
Yeah.
Previous program.
David Appleton has a question for you. Let's go there. Dave, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, so I've got an area of sod with weeds in, grass with weeds in. It's about 30 by 90. I was thinking about turning that over as deeply as I can, leveling it off, and putting prairie plants in there. Once I do that, do I cover it with a little straw or something to make them grow? And do you make packets that I can just spread out that might have 5 to 10 different prairie plants in it? And I don't want them to grow very tall. I wouldn't want them to get much more than 5 inches tall. So how would I approach that?
Well, Doug, you want to take a crack at that?
I'm still working on that. yes, but we wanted something that will take over. The first concern is site prep. That's one of the things we've had to emphasize to people, is you don't really want to till things up, especially if you've got quack grass, because you're then just spreading all the roots around. Secondly, for most of these prairie plants, you need full sun. And most of our homeowners tend to overestimate how much they have. We finally had to define it as you need to have at least 5 hours of midday sun, you know, between 9 and 3, in order for these plants to thrive. So not knowing what you have, I have to admit, before I discovered prairie plants, I spent a lot of time with other ground covers, which is what you're looking for, and that are low and neat. And Pachysandra does well as long as it's not too sunny.
All right, Dave, thank you.
That might answer the question, but I don't know how much we want to dig deeper.
I think your comment on site preparation is really important for Dave to consider, because you want to get rid. You can't just dig up quack grass, because it's just going to go all over the place. There are cover methods. There's ways to to probably get rid of that. And there are some, you have some guides on the on your website, mowing mowing to monarchs. And I expect, I mean, those are for the people who are involved in the program, but I don't imagine you mind whether if somebody else comes on and takes that information and uses it.
One of the reasons we're talking to you is we'd love to share and learn what works for other people.
Yeah.
And frankly, for site prep, if we could do it, we'd prefer that people kill it, whichever word they're going to use, and that could be herbicide, solar, or smothering. But you probably need to allow a year to be sure you're not going to get invaded.
Yeah, I think that's
what you thought you killed.
I think that's very good advice. Dave, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We're talking about the program titled Mowing to Monarchs with our three guests, Dubuque County Master Gardener Coordinator Ray Cruzy, volunteer coach Erica Haugen, and participant mentor Doug Cheever. Questions? I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Taking a look at prairie grasses and prairie flowers today and the Mowing to Monarchs program that's going on in Dubuque County, Iowa, with our three guests today, the Dubuque County Master Gardener Coordinator, Ray Cruzy, volunteer coach Erica Haugen, and participant mentor, Doug Cheever. Again, you can join us if you have a question or comment, or maybe you've been doing something kind of like this as well, like I have. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. And just a quick mention, the second hour of Garden Talk today, Laura Jell will be back, and she'll be talking with us about spring pruning and planting. So we'll look forward to that as well in the second hour of the show. Ray, let me turn to you. It sounds like, you know, Doug was mentioning the number of pocket gardens that have started up, pocket park in parks and elsewhere. In your mind, what's been the impact on Dubuque County?
Yeah, great question. I would say the number one impact on Dubuque County so far has been the value that people have started to see in having native plants on the landscape. So people are becoming educated about what it's like to have native plants, what they look like, and also what those plants are starting to, what they're homes for, if you want to say. They're homes for some insects, they're food for pollinators, or things like that. And folks are liking to see that in their neighborhood. So that's what I would say would be the main benefit that we're seeing.
Yeah, and it's a big one. Wayne in Appleton has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Wayne.
Hi. I'm a big fan of monarch butterflies, all butterflies, but monarchs especially. And I've been seeing a really drastic decrease in population, and I'm wondering what's the cause of that. Is that because of predators? Is it because of pesticides? But also, I like to tag monarch butterflies, and I'm just curious if your guest has ever done that or continues to do that or is involved in tagging monarch butterflies.
All right.
Yeah. So I think there's a few questions there. The first is about the decline in mowing to monarchs. So I don't know if there's research pointing to one specific reason as to the decline. I know one big contributing factor that is pointing to the decline is loss of habitat. But you know, the use of pesticides is something else that is being pointed at as well. But again, I don't know of any specific thing that's coming to the forefront. I know there's a lot of different things that are causing that research is suggesting is the problem, just like honeybees. So that's to answer your first question there. To answer your second question there about tagging, I don't know of anyone in the program that's doing that unless Erica or Doug know of anybody, but I don't know of anybody doing any tagging. I know there's a lot of folks that are recording the insects that they're seeing, and specifically related to the Rusty Patch Bumblebee. But I don't know if Doug or Erica have any input on that.
Doug, or Erica, go ahead.
You know, I don't participate in tagging monarchs, though we do encourage participants to use iNaturalist to observe the insects that we find and the other wildlife that we find in the garden. So we have about 24, I think we have 24 growers right now who have made over 580 observations for 196 species, including the monarch butterfly. And I think I would kind of echo what Ray said, too, is what our goal with the program is to kind of address what we can in small ways. And so what we can do is create these little pockets of habitat throughout the county and our neighborhoods. And we see the insects returning to those pockets very quickly within one season.
That is very cool. And tagging is very cool, too. 2 years ago, I got to tag a monarch at a program that we were doing. And it was kind of a really neat experience for me. Wayne, thank you very much. It was last year, actually. Jill is reminding me. It wasn't 2 years ago. And it was a lot of fun. And we shot a little video, and that video is probably still up on our Larry Mueller Show site, if I'm not mistaken. Wayne, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Dan in Abrams, what's on your mind?
Well, I have about 2 acres. About 6 or 7 years ago, I used an herbicide on most of the lawn and replanted it in wildflowers. It looks spectacular the first year, but gradually the grass seemed to come back and take it over. And then it was just tall and kind of weedy. And I'm wondering what you would recommend. I will probably follow up with an email or a text to mowing the monarchs.
Yeah, that's, Doug, that probably goes back to site preparation.
Partly site preparation, but partly that's what prairies do. If you talk to people that are doing home landscaping, they fairly quickly start using words like editing or curating their plantings, meaning they are in there doing selective, taking things out and putting things in. With 2 acres, that's not super feasible for you. And frankly, it's a little bit out of our scope, but it is, you know, it is possible to, one possibility is if you could take some species that do spread well, and in fact, probably aggressively, such as goldenrod and, purple coneflowers, as well as rattlesnake master, will generally tend to be seed and go around. So you could create drifts within your grassland. Hopefully it is all native grass.
Dan, there you go. And I would, you could also go on the site of Mowing to Monarchs for their information. Prairie Nursery here in Wisconsin is one nursery, Prairie Nursery, and there are other ones as well within the state. If you go online to those sites as well, they may have some advice for you as well on that. Thank you so much for calling. Yeah, go ahead, Doug.
Yeah, I highly recommend Neil DeBole's recent book on Gardener's Guide to Prairies. If you want to know what plants are spectacular, when they grow, what can be transplanted, it's there. And that's extremely useful.
Yeah, It is kind of the book, isn't it?
It is, and it certainly could help you assess where you are. But you know, that is an issue. The prairie does change, and there are over 400 some plants that can't exist in a native prairie, and that's still changing too.
Yeah. It certainly is. Dan, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Do native plants offer a lot that some of our non-natives don't, Doug? And Ray commented on it a bit, but maybe you could add to that. What do native plants offer that non-natives don't?
They support a lot of the little things that have been there, maintaining... you know, creating our healthy environment and climate. We've lived in the same area for 50 years. It really wasn't until we started looking, planting native plants and realizing and looking for what came. And we've used, there's a lot going on. There's a lot of drama. There's life and death and assassins all lurking there, fighting it out. And that goes for plants, too. So it's, for me, you know, it's the Pocket Prairie has given us a nature center right in our front yard. And I'm out there with my camera a lot.
Don, thanks again for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you can email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm interested in the ins and outs of this. There may be somebody listening, and I bet you there are, people who may have a little park in their area where there might be a corner where they could start a program. Or maybe they want to, let's just copy the Moda Monarchs program. What kinds of, I don't know, I don't want to say hoops to jump through, but how do people get involved in Moda Monarchs, Erica?
Well, I think probably the easiest way to start is to head over to the website, and our local extension website is really well maintained, and it has our plant list and our layout. But you're absolutely right that it's these public spaces that are wanting to add these plants. And one of the things I found really exciting is when you start to grow the native plants, you start to recognize them. And our group of growers, our community of growers, is helping to support, like, businesses, for example, that are putting in plants, we notice. And so then we share that within our network. And I think it was like a Target in our area put in native plants in the parking lot. The River Museum did in a bunch of the medians in their parking lot. They planted them all with our Mowing to Monarch plant kit. And then a local brewery did it as well. And so one of the things that we're seeing is businesses are seeing this as a great way to help, you know, support us, but also as a great alternative for their landscaping outside of their business too.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you qualify for the program, how do you qualify for the program, by the way?
So we have an application period, and you have to own the land that you're planting on and commit to maintaining the garden for 3 years. And so we have a limited amount of funding that we can use, but we try to take everyone who's interested in it, we keep them on a list, and then we will kind of work through granting out those programs as we can. Or once we've exhausted the available funding, we have an opportunity for people to buy into the program. So you could, I'm not sure how much it is this year, but it's a really reasonable price to get all of the plants, and then we will still provide you coaching and support to prepare your site and to put those plants in and to maintain them over the 3 years, whether you participate in the grant or the buy-in in Dubuque County.
Yeah,
the key point is you do need to be a resident of Dubuque County. And while we're close to Wisconsin, we've got a lot of your listeners.
Yeah.
But we, you know, if you look at the list, the pocket prairie that for full sun has about 18 different species, 80 total plants, and we've sorted through them so that people who are concerned about whether they are poisonous, we unfortunately had to pull out passflower because of concerns that it had more toxicity than many plants. And so that list is there. And then if you have more shade and want something short, that's also listed. So do take a look at it. One of the differences between Iowa and Wisconsin is our conservation boards are county directed, so that we don't have as active a DNR as Wisconsin does. And as a consequence, our Dubuque County Conservation Board is managing over 2,000 acres, 50 miles of trails in a county of about 100,000 people.
Yeah, that's...
this is a model that could be repeated. Probably the key thing is that volunteer enthusiasm isn't enough. You really need a group pulled together, and that's where Erica has been outstanding. We have a closed Facebook page that participants are on. And so, you know, people are being supported. They don't just get a kit. They get a newsletter. They get instructions. They get a coach that can be there. And that can continue for 3 years. And as we said, we've been able to get a lot of newbies into this. Half of our people are gardening for the first time.
That is very, very cool. And we have a call from, Kirsten in Eau Claire. I mentioned the fact I tagged a monarch butterfly, and I did that, I believe, at the Beaver Creek Reserve. And Kirsten from the Beaver Creek Reserve, or from at least from Eau Claire, is online next. Hi, Kirsten.
Hi, Larry. I just wanted to remind you that you did tag the butterfly at Beaver Creek Reserve. We were so happy to have you. And I just wanted to remind everybody that we do have a native plant sale coming up, and it goes online on April 30th on our website. So everybody can get their native plants.
That is, and when does it go online? Pretty quick.
It goes on our website on April 30th at 9 o'clock, and some of our plants do sell out within like 15 minutes, so you got to be there with your cup of coffee ready.
Well, Kirsten, that was one of the most enjoyable days of the year for me. I had a lot of fun there, and the Beaver Creek Reserve is a fantastic area. It's just a dream area, and it was a lot of fun to be there. I often wondered if that how far that butterfly made it. Thanks so much for calling, Kirsten. Appreciate it very much. Oh, man. So there's a plant sale, and there's a bunch of them going on, I bet, around the state. That's in the Eau Claire area, and there's probably more. I know there are more around the state. Beth in La Crosse, on to you. Hi, Beth.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call today. I was particularly interested in the caller named Wayne, who spoke with you a few minutes ago.
Yeah.
And his interest in monarchs. I'm a Linn County, Iowa master gardener, and we have a fantastic organization in the Cedar Rapids, Marion, Iowa area, which is just 3 hours from La Crosse, so it's a little bit of a drive. But it's a national organization, and on May 18th, they are having a one-day kind of intensive monarch program. A couple of the speakers are, one is on the state of the monarch, and the other speaker is talking about the power of native landscapes. And I thought, and they set up tents, and they have all kinds of information about raising monarchs, protecting monarchs. They sell milkweed. It's a great organization, and I just wanted to share that with your listeners. It's called the Monarch Research Station, and they can easily Google that for more information.
Beth, thank you very much. I appreciate the information. Have you guys been involved at all with, probably not. You've got plenty to worry about yourself with your own project, Ray.
Yeah, no, I can say that we have been involved with them. I know that they are doing work down there and things like that, but we haven't participated. And like you said, it's not that we don't want to, but we do have a lot of other things that we're working on.
You know, it sounds like, well, and you're a master gardener, so that's part of the program, and totally sort of integrated with Extension, the Extension Service, Federal Extension Service, which, you know, obviously the Master Gardener program usually typically runs through Extension. And
sure.
And it feels like this is a great Extension type program because it relies on a lot of cooperation and effort from a lot of folks, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. And that's why when our county conservation educator, Caitlin Moeller, had approached me about this program, she's like, you know, I just don't have the know-how and I don't have the volunteer resources. She's like, would this work as a Master Gardener project? And I mean, I don't go out and instruct people like that you're going to go volunteer. So we operate our Master Gardener program here as you know, here's an opportunity you can take hold. And I relayed this to the Master Gardeners and people like Doug Cheever. We also have some folks that aren't on the call today, like Marilyn Norman, Jackie Kerr, and Amy Sherman, who are all Master Gardeners. I mean, all of those folks you know, joined in on this program after I had relayed this to the group. And you're right, this meets our mission of educating the community through gardening.
Yeah. And Beth, thank you again for your information. You can join in too. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or if you'd like, you could email us, and the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Great to have you along today on Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here as we visit about the Mowing to Monarchs program and prairies with our guest today, Dubuque County Master Gardener Coordinator Ray Cruzy, volunteer coach Erica Haugen, and participant mentor Doug Cheever. Questions, give a call at 800-642-1234. Or email to talk@WPR.org. Quick note, next week on Garden Talk, Bruce Spangenberg is back to cover spring chores, and then we'll talk about growing pawpaws, which I've never done. So I'll learn right along with you as we talk there. But now the Mowing to Monarchs program and prairie questions again, 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Linda emailed that in years prior, she had lots of milkweed in her CRP fields. Last year, she didn't see a single plant and no monarchs. She's not the only one who noticed their milkweed plants did not return last year. Not sure where she's calling, where she emailed from. But she's wondering, what do you think happened? There were no sprays in the area or no spraying. There weren't any animals grazing except for, of course, deer, which there's always deer. Any ideas as to why the milkweed suddenly disappeared from that area?
I could take that if you'd like, Larry.
Yeah, go ahead, Ray.
Yeah, so Doug had mentioned earlier that, you know, prairies kind of change every year. And I never knew that to be, you know, the thing until I had attended an Iowa Prairie Network summer conference. And we went to a few different prairies. And I'd seen, you know, in the life, you know, that, you know, one year we might see a ton of these flowers and the next year we might not. And so, going back to what your speaker is seeing there, I'm wondering if, you know, one year was favorable for those plants to exist. They ceased to exist, or maybe they may they maybe cease to exist, or they may be drastically less in terms of population 1 year, and they might return in another. So it is fluid, if you want to say. So I guess I wouldn't be discouraged. It maybe is concerning, but I don't think I would be discouraged.
Yeah, I guess I would agree with that. I was thinking about my own plot where I had, actually the milkweed in my plot was getting to be aggressive and I had to do some pruning to get some of the milkweed actually out before it overtook the whole plot. But with, it's something a little easier to do, Doug, if you're working with a 10 by 15 or a 10 by 10 area. It's, I think, a little easier to do that kind of work, don't you think?
Yes, that is one advantage. And again, as I said, it's a nature center in your front yard. People have really, even a space 10 by 10, it's great to run a path through the middle of it and walk through that once a day and see what's there and see what's happening. We probably should explain that while the title is Mowing to Monarchs, we've kind of moved over towards pollinators. And while it's a catchy title, we're doing more to follow where the bumblebees are going. And what's been striking is these small pocket prairies have attracted literally dozens of rusty patch bumblebees, which are endangered, and there's a lot of programs trying to revive them, but they're still around and they are still attracted to even a small plot. So as one person said, it's great, I believe I can make a difference in my little corner of the world. And that is true. You don't have to do the whole dang yard. Pick a place that is a problem along the street. We've seen rusty patch bumblebees there. Or go into the backyard where you've got a section that's being taken over by Creeping Charlie.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good advice. And that you're right about the rusty patch bumblebee. And it's really, I was going to say surprising, but I guess maybe a better word is encouraging to see suddenly the appearance of all these bees.
I just want to share a little story about that. We had one of our NASA gardeners also volunteers with her elementary school and worked with the Mowing to Monarchs plant list to apply for a grant from the city of Dubuque to purchase plants that are on our plant list. And we planted those plants at the elementary school in May. And my husband is a teacher there. And when I went to the school with him, it's August, I think, when they're getting ready to go back to school. And I was checking on the prairie and walked into their garden, which the volunteers did a beautiful job of laying out. But I immediately saw 3 rusty patch bumblebees on this garden that was planted in May. And I was just so excited. And then a little bit later that year, one of the students was really excited to show me a chrysalis that she had found from a monarch and was just explaining to me the whole life cycle of the caterpillars. So it's really exciting to see how, you can replicate this even without going directly through our grant program and make it your own, and how excited people get and how engaged they get and how quickly it builds this habitat.
I would certainly agree, Eric, and thanks for those comments. And I went to your site, I was more than once, actually, and I was looking at the growing guides, custom-made program growing guides, I think it was called, that you've put together through some, probably trial and error a little bit, but you've got a whole list of good information. I clicked on the information myself, and I thought, man, this is what a person needs. And I don't know if you've got those in front of you, Doug or Erica or Ray, but you've got site considerations before your pocket prairie arrives. You've got creating a planting plan before your prairie arrives. You've got, well, let's see. Yeah. I'm trying to remember.
You'd like me to share the short link, Larry?
Yeah, go ahead, Ray.
Yeah, so we have a short link for the page for folks to hopefully more easily access it. It's HTTPS with the two colons, and then we have the /, and then it's a bit.ly link, so it's bit.ly, and we have another /, and then it's mo, and then the number 2, and then M-O-N. So, we shorten it up so that hopefully it's a little more accessible and relatable over the radio.
Yeah, and I actually think and we'll put that up on our page for today, the Garden Talk page for today, so people can, if they didn't get that written down, which I'm sure they didn't, we'll have it there. Jill will put it up, and we'll have it there for people. And probably, I'm trying to remember, if you just go to, if you type in Mowing to Monarchs, Dubuque, which is what I did the first time, you go to the site, you find the site, and if you scroll down the site a little bit, you come to those growing guides. And they really are helpful. And, you know, you're planting with a stone pathway, planting on the south side of a building, planting a simple grid pattern, planting with randomized stones, planting on both sides of a sidewalk, transplanting prairie plugs, fall season pocket prairie care, second growing season care, and third year prairie care and considerations, and some others as well. So a lot of really good information, whether you're a part of the program or you're not part of the program, you can take advantage of this and learn a whole lot more about what's going on. So, Erica, how many hours a week do you spend on this?
So I love this. I don't actually have to spend a lot of time on it, but I do love to answer questions. And so I'm happy to help do that if people send me a Facebook message or I'm also on Instagram if they want to message me there. They can do that. And usually I can refer them back to the website because there is so much information here. And I think the most important thing that we have done with this program is make it accessible. When I first started, I wanted to do this program. I prepped the site, and I stalled because I didn't know how to pick plants. I didn't know what would work. I wanted to do it in my front yard. I was afraid I was going to invest and kill them all because I didn't know what I was doing. And really, the plant list is wonderful. They are all of them are pretty easy to grow in various site conditions and in various soils. They do need the sun, but we have that part shade mix as well. They took the guesswork out of it, and then they gave us these plans to go with these plant kits so that it looks like a professional garden when you're done. It's really something when you see them from start to finish in a space that was well planned. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is indeed. And as we wind up here, I want to thank all three of you for taking time to be with us today. Really appreciate it. Our Dubuque County Master Gardener Coordinator, Ray Cruzy, our volunteer coach, Erica Haugen, and the participant mentor, Doug Cheever. Obviously, they're quite enthusiastic about the program. And I hope you'll take a look. Go online to the Mowing to Monarch site. Take a look at it and take a look at the guides. I think, and the photos. There's some great photos of gardens that have already been done. Appreciate their effort very, very much. Coming up, we're going to talk about spring pruning and planting, among other things, with our next guest, Laura Jell. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us today for Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. You know, we always get a lot of questions about pruning. So today we have one of our experts back to help you out with that and a whole lot more. Laura Gelbeck with us. She's an associate professor and extension specialist in the College of Ag and Life Sciences at UW-Madison. She's an expert on woody ornamentals. She knows a lot about nursery management and landscape installation and, of course, maintenance and tree care. So maybe you're wondering if you can still prune, or maybe you're wondering if you can still plant, or maybe you have other woody ornamental plant questions that you might want to ask Laura about. I hope you'll join in. You can call us at 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Laura Gell, good to have you back. Thanks for joining today.
Hi, Larry. How are you? Thanks for having me.
I'm doing great, and I hope you are as well. Pruning comes to mind right away for me, and as we think about it, I mean, is it getting too late maybe for some species or not?
No. Actually, this is a great time to prune your trees and shrubs. They haven't leafed out yet. You can see what you're doing. A lot of the insects and diseases are not quite active yet. It's a great time. And if you're going to be pruning, I would make sure you have the right tools and able to work hard.
Yes, indeed. Able to work hard. And shrubs as well. Trees and shrubs, I guess, huh?
Yeah. The only thing is, if you are pruning shrubs that are going to flower in spring, you are removing some of the flower buds.
Yeah.
That's the only downfall. However, I like to prune right now because I can see the architecture of the shrub, and I know, I can guide my pruning cuts accordingly. But if you don't want to sacrifice flowers in the spring, you can prune after it flowers. But I would do it soon after, because sometime in the summer, they start to set their flower buds for next year.
Makes good sense. Anne in Harmony, Minnesota has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Anne.
Hi there. So nice to be near there. I have a dwarf weeping crab apple. There's so many adjectives. I often get it wrong. But I missed pruning this year. And I'm just wondering what would happen if I did some of it now.
Like I said, this is a great time to prune. You're in Minnesota, so nothing has leafed out yet. You can prune right now. Just be aware you are removing some flower buds.
Yeah. So get those pruning shears out, Anne. I would, we got the weekend coming up. It's probably a good time to get that all done.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Oh, Carol in Manitowoc has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Carol.
Good afternoon. I have a question. My husband had come home and said that he had heard that there's some sort of bug or disease that is starting to affect the white spruce trees. I'm wondering if that's valid or invalid right now.
Well, the white spruce, our native white spruce, can get a number of insects and diseases, and there's nothing new, really. One of the most common diseases that spruce can get, actually, there's two of them. There's Cytospora canker, and then, of course, Rhizosphera needle cast, which causes the needles to drop. And it's so common. I see it all over the place. At the Arboretum, we have a number of white spruce that just about you want to cut down because there's very few needles left. And it's a disease that's around. There's not much you can do about it except, there's a fact sheet on Brian Huddleston's plant disease clinic at UW-Madison on various spruce diseases that you can download for free. I don't have his address of his website in front of me, but those are good places to go to. But it's not a new disease. They've had it for quite some time.
Yeah. And if you just type into your search engine, UW-Madison Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, I think it's PDDC at UW, well, just type in Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, and Jeff's looking it up, and we'll have the exact for you. But I think that's really good advice from Laura. Carol, thank you for calling. Betty in Ashland, we'll go to you. Hi, Betty.
Hello there.
What's on your mind?
I want to know if we're too late to trim up our apple trees up here near Ashland. We've got a lot of water spouts and, you know, crossing branches still.
Yeah, no, that was a great time, just especially with water sprouts, because they don't produce any flower buds. They're just vegetative. And so I would get rid of those, any suckers at the base of the tree. And then if you do need to prune scaffold branches, just realize that you are sacrificing some of the flower buds, which means less fruit. But with the suckers and the water sprouts, they don't produce flowers or fruit.
Yeah, and so when you've got branches that are kind of overlapping in a way,
yeah,
Laura,
crossing branches.
Yeah, where do you take those off? You take them off right at the tree, don't you?
Yeah. Well, what you do? I actually have three fact sheets on the Wisconsin Horticulture Division of Extension website, and one is on pruning shrubs, another is on pruning trees, and the last one is on pruning evergreens. And they're two-page simple fact sheets that show you where to prune. When you're pruning larger limbs or any limbs off of a tree, you want to make sure not to cut it flush. You don't want flush cuts, meaning right against the trunk.
Right.
You want to protect the branch collar at all costs. And it's easier for you to look at the picture online than it is for me to describe it. But you do three different cuts. First is a bottom cut. Outside of that, you know, about 6 inches away from the trunk. The second cut is outside of that first cut, going from the top down instead of the bottom up like the first cut. And then the limb will fall off. Then you'll have a longer stub. You're not done yet. Then you're going to want to remove that stub. But again, you're not cutting it flush. You want to protect the branch collar. There's a number of reasons why.
Well,
like I said, you can go to the fact sheet and see it, the diagram.
What's the main reason why you protect that collar?
Well, there's a number of reasons, Larry, because if you're cutting that branch back flush to the trunk, you're actually cutting into trunk tissue, not just branch tissue. And that invites pathogens that could technically invade the trunk and cause cankers and a number of issues. The other reason why is, plus the cut would be a larger diameter cut than if you were just to remove the branch. Other reasons, protecting that branch collar is to allow for quicker wound closure. You're not cutting into the trunk tissue, the branch tissue that's left very little. You're not leaving stubs, but you're not cutting it flush. That will eventually form callus, and the callus tissue eventually will close that wound.
You know, that was a great description, and I was thinking as you were talking, you know, we usually talk about cutting it at the collar, but we rarely do we talk about, well, why do we? What's the difference? So it was a great answer to that. Thank you so much for that. John in Mount Horeb, your turn now. Hi, John.
Yes, thank you. I have a question about emerald ash borer. We have two high-value trees in our yard. They're ash trees, obviously, and they probably have trunk diameters of, I would say, 18 or 20 inches. We have been routinely treating them every other year for many years now. We've had a professional come in and do the injections of, I think it's triage, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. So, but as the trees get bigger, it's getting a little more expensive to have these treatments. My question is, I've read about some granules of something, I don't know what, that can be sprinkled around the base of the trees that also would be effective against the emerald ash borers. Are those granules as effective? And if so, is there a particular ingredient that I should look for when buying those?
They're not as effective, and I don't recommend them because your trees are so large. I would get them professionally injected with the triage. And the triage is injected in, for those who don't know, is injected in the root flare going around the trunk of the tree. It's taken up by the tree, and it's inside the tree. It's not like a pesticide spray. It's inside the tree. Ash are wind pollinated, so insects generally don't, you know, aren't on the ash trees. And it's done typically right about now. I've had it done every other year too on my ash tree. It's worth the cost, considering if those trees die, the cost of removal of the trees, you lose the shade, and you have to replant, and it will be decades before you have anything that's that large to shade your home. It's worth the investment.
And I'm sure the cost varies from one area to another. What in general terms? Well, John, how much are you being quoted for it at your place in Mount Horeb?
I think we're being quoted about $300 per tree of these larger trees.
Okay.
Yeah, it's because you have a large tree. And anytime they get larger, the price goes up. That's why, because the chemical that is used is quite expensive.
And you obviously need more of it for a larger tree.
Yep.
So yep. $600, is it every other year or is it every year?
Every other year.
All right, so then you're thinking $300 a year.
It's worth it.
Yeah, so over the, 10 years, you got a little money invested, but in about 10 years, that's what it would cost you to cut the darn thing down, too.
Oh, yeah.
$3,000 or so. And then, and I have experience with that, financial experience with that, with a very large one in my back lawn. And sometimes it's expensive because there's the people that are doing it are working in a small area, and it takes a bit of time to get those trees down. So I would rather be injecting and thinking, okay, I'm spending $300 a year per tree. But there you go. John, there you go. If I was you, I'd keep injecting. Carol in Sparta, we'll get to you in just a minute. A reminder, our guest today, Laura Jull, Associate Professor and Extension Specialist in the College of Ag and Life Sciences. She knows a whole lot about pruning and woody ornamentals and nursery management and maintenance and tree care, our guest. And you can join in. The number is 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Thanks for joining us here on Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here, and great to have you with us as we talk pruning and planting trees and shrubs and a whole lot more with our guest Laura Jull from the UW-Madison College of Ag and Life Sciences. She's an extension specialist as well. Always great to have her come by. And the number is 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. Carol in Sparta, we'll give you a chance. Thanks for joining in.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. Afternoon. Appreciate the call.
I have a question. I want to plant a new tree, spruce tree this year, replace one that I had to have removed. And I've kind of found one in someone's yard. It's a soft needle spruce. But I don't know what type it is or where you can purchase it, or I just need help with that, I think.
Okay. There's a couple questions I have. If it's soft needle spruce, it's probably not a spruce. is probably a fir tree, and firs look very similar to spruce. There's an easy way to tell it apart. If you take a needle and very gently pull it off, if there is like a little peg still attached to the needle, it's probably a spruce. And if the needles come off and there's no little woody peg attached, then it could be a fir. But there's other ways to tell it apart. With fir trees, you're not going to have any cones on the ground because the cones disintegrate on the plant and they never fall as a complete unit. Whereas spruce trees, you'll have lots of cones on the ground and up in the tree. Regarding the question was what to replace it with. If you had a spruce, did it die from diseases?
Yeah.
Yeah, then I would not plant another spruce because they're all susceptible to the diseases that spruce get, to be very honest. I would plant something different. There's lots of different evergreens you could plant. It depends a lot on your soil. Have you had a soil test done?
I haven't. It's heavy clay soil.
Okay, then you're not going to want to plant a fir either. You're better off planting, you know, something like an arborvitae that can tolerate a little bit more clay. Junipers, as long as it's well-drained soil, you can plant junipers. There's a number of them. They come in all different shapes and sizes and colors. The best bet is to go to your local garden center or nursery that is open for retail business and take a look at what they have. There's lots of different choices out there.
Yeah, and it brings to mind another question just relating to purchasing trees, and that's can you buy them bare root at this time of the year, or are they all in pots, or what?
Typically with evergreens, they're not bare root. There are some available. I don't know if they still do this, but the DNR had little seedlings that were available bare root, but you got to get them in the ground soon because once they start to break bud, they should not be bare root. And that's for little plants like a foot tall.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they're available bald and burlapped or in containers. Regardless of the method of production, you need to make sure that root flare is at the soil line. So if you get it in a pot, the root flare is often buried in the pot, and you need to scrape the top of the pot, the soil off until you start seeing that flare coming out. You also, with containerized plant material, the roots often grow around and around and around. And those roots actually have to be very carefully stretched out like spokes of a bike. You don't want those roots to continue to spiral around in the potting hole. You need to spread those roots out. And then, of course, same with bald and burlap, though. You're not going to have the spiraling roots. The most important thing with bald and burlap trees is, of course, getting that root flare right at the soil line, remove the basket, peel back the burlap, or get rid of it altogether. It's very important you do this.
Yeah, and I guess if it probably doesn't hurt to have it fairly wet.
Yes, you want the root ball, whether it's container or bald and burlap, you want it moist. You don't want a dry ball or a dry pot.
I'd soak it in and let it sit for a bit, and so that the roots themselves then become a little more flexible.
Yeah.
Yeah. Carol, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Patrick and Madison, your turn. Hi, Patrick.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Great. So I planted, 70 or so arborvitae trees back 30 years ago. They've gotten so tall, I'd like to cut them back maybe 20, 30%. And I'm not sure if that's going to kill the tree or if it's okay to do.
So you're thinking about cutting the top off?
Yeah, substantially, like maybe 20 or 30% of the height.
Okay.
Okay. At one time of pruning, you don't want to remove more than 20% 20-25% of a plant's canopy in terms of trees. Shrubs, it's a little different. But with trees, you don't want to remove that much. That's a lot. 30% is an awful lot. You might send that plant into shock. But you can bring some of the taller branches down to a lower branch. You wouldn't just randomly cut them straight across because that would look goofy, and it just wouldn't be the most aesthetic way. So I would take some of the larger branches, do it over the course of a year, take some of the larger branches back down to a node or where another branch is coming off. Try to hide your pruning cuts. Always prune back to a lateral branch. Do not do random internode cuts. That's not good. But, you know, it might be time to replace it with something else. You could cut them all down and replant. That gets expensive and timely. But you don't want to do super drastic cuts straight across. You want to do it judiciously and over time.
So maybe do some this year and then finish it right off next year.
Yes.
Yeah, that makes sense to me as well. Patrick, there you go. Thank you for calling. Mark in Kakana, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hello. Yes, I have a couple of nice ash trees in my yard, about two-thirds grown. And last year they came down with emerald ash borer, so I had them professionally treated. And then when I started looking closer at the trees, there's branches, just a few on each tree, where you can see that they've been gnawed on. And I'm wanting to know, they're not, the branches aren't dead, but they look pretty rough. And I'm wondering if I should cut those branches off. And if I do, how do I dispose of the branches properly?
Okay, well, you kind of went out there for a second. What is gnawing on the branches?
Emerald ash borer.
Okay, I didn't know if there was an animal in there, too. Well, when you say gnawing on the branches, are you seeing those D-shaped exit holes, or are you seeing actual chewing of the branches?
I'm seeing exit holes on the branches.
Okay. That makes more sense. You can prune those branches out if you need. You know, some ashes will have the exit holes, but the insects inside the tree may be already dead. So I would do the scratch test with your fingernail on the young twigs and see if it's green underneath. If it is green underneath, those branches are still alive, and they don't necessarily need to be cut. I just had my ash tree pruned, and now is a great time. Before, you know, it gets too hot out and you can see what you're doing. Realize if your tree has been treated, was it this year?
Last fall.
Okay. You're going to wait another year before you would have to treat it again. It's an every other year application. It's not a one and done. There's plenty of emerald ash borer around town. And if you don't treat your trees, unfortunately, and I'm not a big pesticide person, but if you don't treat your trees, the emerald ash borer will find them, believe me. And it's good to have your tree protected ahead of time. Now, regarding the removal of the branches, I set mine out at the curb because the city is coming to chip the take away the branches. But I would make sure to keep it away from, you know, basically any other ash tree potentially. But yeah, I don't know if you have city brush pickup, but if you do, I would put it out at the curb and have them take it.
Okay. Mark, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. You can join in too. Number's 800-642-1234. Let's go to Mike in Manakwa next. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Larry. How you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
I wanted to plant a couple of serviceberry shrubs or small tree, and I have a sandy soil, and I wanted to know if I have to wait until the nighttime temperatures are above freezing to do that.
I would wait probably a couple. I don't. Where are you?
Manakwa.
Manakwa. Oh, way up there. Yep. Yeah, I'd probably plant them early May It's a good time to get them into the ground up there. Kudos to you for planting a wonderful tree. Service berries are great plants, and they provide fruit for the birds as well as me. They're very edible and delicious.
Mike, there you go. Hang on. Wait a little while. First part of May, maybe. You can join in again, 800-642-1234. Alice would like to know how and when to, and this is an email, how and when to trim lilac bushes. Hers are very old and woody.
That's a great question. Again, I would refer people to the fact sheet I have on the UW Division of Extension horticulture website, and they will be putting these up on, I think, your website after the show. They're wonderful. I don't want to say wonderful because I'm the author. That sounds arrogant. But they're good resources, and it shows you exactly how to prune. For large lilacs, I would do selective thinning cuts where you're taking the largest diameter branches back to the base of the plant, and you would leave the younger, thinner branches behind that are coming from the ground. And you would do this over the course of several years. So just do about a third of them now. The next year, you do another third, and so on. You are removing flower buds, but as those lilac branches get really large in diameter, they become more susceptible to lilac borers, as well as the flowers' production goes down. And the flowers will be so high up that you can't enjoy them. You can't see them or smell them. And I love the smell of lilac. So doing thinning pruning, about a third of the largest diameter branches back to the base of the plant every couple of years so that young sucker growth will come back. And that young sucker growth that comes back will produce flowers that you can see and smell.
It is amazing, the difference. I had a lilac on one of my other homes and did that, and it's just absolutely amazing how those flower buds come out the next year. I loved it a lot. Judith emailed to ask when you can prune or split lavender.
I'm not sure what she means by split. You mean division?
Divide, I think, is what.
Okay, division. Division you can do very soon. This is the time of year to divide your perennials. Wait till the ground, obviously, is not frozen, which around here in Madison is not frozen anymore. And it's a great time to divide your plants, especially, you know, the month of April, before growth initiates. And then the other question was pruning of your lavender. Lavender, you know, I've been trying to grow it in my yard for years, and it's often winter killed. A lot of the cultivars that are available are not cold hardy, even though the tag will say zone 5. It's like, no. You want to wait to prune your lavender until probably spring. After it leaves out, remove any of the dead material. I experimented with this. I cut mine all the way back in spring, and nothing came back. So I waited until the growth initiated, if it did at all, and then remove any of the dead branches.
I want to go back, before we go back to the phones, I wanted to go back to an email because it has to do with lilacs, because the caller was wondering if you can dig up lilac suckers and replant them.
Yes, you can. As long as you get the roots, as many of the roots as possible, and you're not damaging the mother tree or shrub.
Barbara in La Crosse, we'll go to you. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Thank you, guys. My question was back to those service berries. I got a service berry as well, or I'm getting it in 2 days, and I'm curious, I'm doing it in clay soil. Do I need to wait till May? Because they said I could plant it now.
Where are you located?
La Crosse, Wisconsin.
Okay, La Crosse. It's farther up north. The thing is, you want to get the plants in the ground before they leaf out, if at all possible. Once they start to bud out, I would wait a little bit and then you can plant them. But as long as, actually, if they're already dug, you can plant them regardless. If you're transplanting them from one place to your yard to another, I would do it now before it leaves out. Clay soils, you know, heavy clay soil is not great for service berry. They like a little bit more loamy type of soil. You never want to amend the hole with any soil. That actually is not a good thing. You would probably want to dig a very large hole or planting area and then kind of scuff up the sides. If it's solid clay, I'm sorry to say, but service berry will not do well in clay.
Hmm. Barb, does that help out?
Well, this is a garden bed that's been there for years with some. So I'm thinking the soil's already been amended. So
okay, that's different. Yeah, I thought you were planting like a street tree that, you know, a lot of these, the soil gets worse the closer you get to the street. And, you know, when you dig the hole, if it's like a solid glaze of clay, yeah, service berry won't like that. But in a garden bed, yeah, you can plant. There's various types of service berry you can plant. There are large, most of them are small trees. They're not little shrubs. So you got to make sure you give it enough room to plant. And I would, yeah, you can plant. I personally wait until the ground is a little bit warmer. The soil temperature is a little bit warmer, probably about end of April.
Barb's in La Crosse, so
yeah, it might still be too good. Get a soil thermometer and measure the temperature of the soil.
Yeah, what is it? What should it be?
Oh, good question.
50.
Yeah, I'd say about 50 or warmer. And also remember, we're not done with snow yet. I don't. I've had 7 inches of snow in my yard on April 18th. So, and I live in near Madison. So,
yeah, Barbara, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Bill in Oregon, we'll go to you now. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I got a common problem, but I'm looking for a shrub a shade tolerant shrub that I can use as a deer barrier, or you know, a small tree or a shrub. I'm trying to block a space that's about 4 or 5 feet wide, and I'm just I'm trying to think of a plant that I could put there that they won't eat, but also gets big enough that at least it makes it difficult to pass, in a sense.
Yeah.
Well, good luck. They eat so many things. Arborvitae being their favorite snack. I'm referring to my extension pub, but I do have an extension pub on plants that are not favored by deer or deer resistant. And I don't want to say resistant because if deer are hungry enough, they'll eat anything. And that publication's on the Wisconsin Horticulture Extension Horticulture website. I think it's still up. I hope it is.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, various shrubs you can use and that are shade tolerant, that runs less on the list that you can use. You know, they'll eat hydrangeas. That's a shade tolerant plant, but they'll eat it. How tall are you looking for it to be?
Hopefully like 3 to 4 feet, possibly.
Yeah.
You know, I can tolerate it getting a little taller than that, but.
Yeah. You know, what's your soil type?
It's pretty mesic. We're kind of a glacial dump.
Okay. I'm trying to rack my brain off the top of my head. I can think of a lot of different shrubs that tolerate shade, but are they truly deer resistant? I'm getting older and my brain doesn't work as well anymore, so I would refer to that publication. I don't want to recommend a shade-tolerant shrub that the deer like, but like I said, that a publication is available out there to look, because all the shrubs I'm thinking of off the top of my head, the deer like, that are shade-tolerant.
So UW Extension Horticulture UW Extension Horticulture website, UW Madison Extension Horticulture website will get you there, Bill. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Well, Laura Jull, our guest today, associate professor and extension specialist in the College of Ag and Life Sciences at UW-Madison. And we're talking trees and shrubs with her. We've talked pruning. We've talked about care a bit. You have a question. I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Great to have you with us for Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Laura Jull. We're talking a lot about trees and shrubs today and pruning. She can certainly talk about native tree selection and other topics as well. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. And let's go to Susan in Coon Valley next. Hi, Susan.
Hi there. I have a question about yew plants. We made a mistake, I think, when we first moved on our farm setting to plant these yew plants near the house. And I trim them back every year, but my God, they've just taken over. I mean, they got such a horrific root system. How do you get rid of these, or what do you do with them? I mean, they're beautiful when they're growing and you know, when they're big, but they take over everything.
Yeah.
So these are yews you're trying to get rid of?
Yes.
The only way to really get rid of them is to dig them up, dig up the root system and the plants and haul them away. That's really the best way to get rid of them. You could reduce the size if you want to keep some evergreen there. You can prune back larger branches back to where they meet another branch, again, protecting that branch collar. That would be what I would suggest. Bring down the height of it if it's getting too tall. Yews are very forgiving.
And if you want to get rid of them entirely, a little chainsaw at the base or thereabouts?
Yeah, I would recommend that. And again, if you don't want to dig them up, you can spray a herbicide directly after you cut the stems back. But I'm not a big fan of that. That's just me personally. But that can be done.
Susan, there you go. Thank you so much. Summer emailed to ask how to protect her 3-year-old heirloom apple tree. This winter, it's been faced with something eating it. She doesn't know if it's squirrels or chipmunks or whatever, rodent.
Is it at the base of the tree or is it in the branches?
It doesn't. She doesn't say. So,
if it's on the branches, it's probably deer. If it's at the base of the tree, like around the trunk, it's probably voles that chew on the bark and can girdle the tree. And the best way to protect your trees is installing some type of fencing around the tree before winter, actually in late fall, and you would put it around the diameter of the tree. That would help keep perhaps the deer off, though. The deer can get on their back legs, and they can eat things that are 6-8 feet tall if they want to. To protect the base of the tree from voles or other critters from chewing on the bark, that would, first of all, make sure the bark mulch is not touching the trunk of the tree. It should never touch the trunk of the tree, because that provides a nice home for over winter for voles. You also want, whatever you use, you want to put it around the base of the tree far enough down that the voles can't dig underneath it. And that's hard to do, I'll be honest with you. Sometimes, you know, I'm not a big fan of the white corkscrew type tree protectors. People forget them and they leave them on too long, and they can actually girdle the trunk and cause the trunk to be misformed. I would use something that goes around the trunk down to the ground to help protect it. And it's not fail-safe, but it could perhaps reduce some injury.
Let's take a call from Charlie in Richfield, Minnesota next. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, good morning. Say, last year I planted, last spring, a small spruce tree about 2 feet tall, white spruce, and it was wet spring, so we had plenty of water. Then we had a dry spell over the summer, and it got drier, but I kept watering it a little bit. And in the fall, I gave it a lot of water, and it was very green all winter. And about a month ago, some of the needles, especially at the tip, started to fall off. And now I bet over half the needles have fallen off. And I just wondered if there's no insects active right now, so just wondered what that could be.
It could be a root issue. I would, you know, at this point, I don't know if this plant will survive. It might be a disease pathogen in the soil that has attacked your tree, a root rot, crown rot. There's many things that could be wrong with it. I would give Brian Huddleston at the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic a call or, email him and see what he recommends. There is a way. I mean, you can dig up the whole plant, but then you don't have the plant anymore and send it to him. But I'm curious, is your soil well-drained?
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's not puddling water at all?
No. Not right now, no. Mm-mm.
Okay, because, it's probably some root disease. If the needles are falling off, yeah, that's the first thing I suspect.
Charlie, so Brian Huddleston at the UW Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic is the guy to contact. I think it's pddc.wi.uw.edu. EX, I believe.
Yeah, I'm not sure off the top of my head, but just Google.
I think it's .edu, pddc.wi.edu.
Yeah.
There you go. Drake in Green Bay emailed. He has about a 30-foot Japanese yew looking kind of sickly. And he, as an aside, says, like a lot of them this time of the year. Only his has looked that way since beginning last spring and summer. The needles seem more sparse and yellowing. Can mm-hmm. he fertilize the roots with watering spike and expect any success?
No, I don't recommend that. Your plant is in stress, and fertilizing it right now is not something I recommend. Fertilizer is not a cure-all. And it sounds like you've got some potential root issue going on. If it's really sparse, and yews are really sensitive to poor drainage. If it's by a downspout from a house, or if it's an area subject to flooding, or even puddling of water, yews do not like that at all, and you'll get thinning of the canopy. 30-foot yew is a large yew. So perhaps, again, send samples of infected branches to Brian at the disease clinic and see what he has to say. But, you're going to have a lot of yews this time of year are starting to show winter burn. If it's on one side of the plant, then it's typically winter burn. Yews are very forgiving. You can prune them back and they will produce new leaves. You don't have that with junipers. So I would go that route.
Babs in Sparta emailed to ask if you can't plant the tree yet, where do you store it? Garage during evenings and outside during the day?
Yeah. In fact, my garage has some potted woody plants in it that I didn't get in the ground last year, and they're still fine. The only problem is they're starting to break bud, and if I put them outside, and of course we're going to get frost, that would zap that new growth. So, I'm going to be putting them outside here soon so that they get some sunlight. But if the temperatures go below, freezing, then they have to come back into the garage because you don't want the root ball freezing.
Varieties have you been impressed with lately, tree varieties? And then maybe talk about shrub varieties that you've been impressed with.
Oh, I am impressed with everything, Larry. When it comes to plants, herbaceous, woody, it doesn't matter. Mother Nature provides us with such wonderful plants. I really like viburnums. That's one of my favorite group of plants. Unfortunately, like anything else, we have insects that are attacking viburnums, the viburnum leaf beetle and viburnum borers. I'm still a huge fan of Carlesii, the Korean spice viburnum. And there's a number of varieties out there or cultivars out there to choose from. I like Spice Island quite a bit. It's here bred in Wisconsin. And Spice Island and I'm trying to think of the other one. I got two different cultivars in my yard, but they're really nice plants. And the flowers occur about the first week of May, and they are incredibly fragrant, and they smell so nice. I used to recommend Arrowwood viburnum, but viburnum leaf beetle is pretty much ruled that out. They eat the leaves. Other trees that I really like, I'm a huge fan of chinquapin oak or any oaks, particularly chinquapin. It's native to Wisconsin. It tolerates higher pH quite well. I also like white oaks, but got to watch the soil pH on that. You know, sometimes everybody's in a rush to get the latest and greatest plants on the market, and I'm not always impressed with all the new stuff that's coming out. Sometimes the old standbys are great landscape plants. I can think of, you know, I'm really a big fan of plants that attract pollinators, and we need to be planting those kinds. And it can be native or non-native. There's been research that's done out of, I think it's the University of Kentucky, that show there's plenty of non-native plants that attract pollinators just fine. And I'm a big fan of our native St. John's wort, Hypericum Calmianum. That is a plant that is a bee magnet, a herbaceous perennial that also attracts a lot of pollinators, is not native, but I can't even count the number of pollinators on it. And that is the lesser calamint. It's not a mint, it's a calamint. It was in the genus Calamintha. It's now changed, but a lot of labels haven't made the change. But as for Montrose White is the cultivar, and I have two of them in my front yard. And from the months of late June all the way until frost, that thing is always in flower, and it has hundreds of pollinators, bees, wasps, not the nasty wasps, but the wasps, they're more interested in the pollen than you. And that's a great plant.
Give the name of that again.
Okay, it's Calamintha.
Calamintha.
Calamintha. And it's also known as lesser calamint. The cultivar that I particularly like is called Montrose, Montrose White. And that's a superb plant.
And you're recommending that you could, if you want to prune right now on trees, pretty much any tree, you can still do it, and probably a good time to do it is right now.
Yep.
Okay.
However, one thing I want to quickly say, if it's an oak, it's too late.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Don't do oaks. Right.
Or even elm and oaks. They need to be in the dormant season. Do not prune them. It's past April 1st. And it's getting warmer, hopefully.
Yeah.
I pruned my oak over a week ago, and that was at the tail end of when we could.
Can do it. On that happy note, Laura, thank you so much for being with us. We'll look forward to your next visit. Thanks, Laura.
Thank you for having me, Larry.
Laura Jahl, Associate Professor and Extension Specialist in the College of Agricultural and Life Sciences at the UW-Madison, our guest. Always fun to have her come by. Talking about improving your sleep habits on Monday, but a big thanks to for joining in today. Really appreciate it. Our show is a team effort. Our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnod, technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive producer, Jill Nadeau, of course. I'm Larry Mueller, and hey, stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.